This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The culture wars have gone international, and at the center of them is who controls women's fertility. That's the premise of the new book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, by my guest, Michelle Goldberg. She says reproductive rights are the place where many of the crucial forces shaping and changing women's lives intersect. Religious authority, globalization, patriarchal tradition, international law, feminism, and American foreign policy. One example of how American foreign policy can come into play is the so-called gag rule that said the U.S. would not offer financial aid to health and family planning organizations around the world that performed or promoted abortion. The policy was begun under President Reagan, rescinded by President Clinton, reinstated under President Bush, and rescinded again by President Obama. Michelle Goldberg is a former senior writer for Salon.com, where she wrote extensively about the Christian right. She's now a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. Her previous book was called Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. Michelle Goldberg, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why, after writing a book on Christian nationalism, did you want to focus on reproductive issues around the world?
I would say there are two reasons. The first is that while I was, you know, working on this book about religious fundamentalism in American politics, I really saw a lot of the groups that I was writing about getting involved internationally. Even though they disliked and distrusted the United Nations, they saw the power it was wielding and they started to organize within it. They started building alliances with fundamentalist movements around the world, including with some conservative Muslim groups. So I was, you know, kind of fascinated in the globalization of the phenomenon that I had first written about domestically. And at the same time, after spending a year immersed in a world whose values were in many ways very hostile to my own, even if the people were often quite lovely, it was such a relief to spend time with women all around the world who were fighting the very forces that I had written about in my first book.
Some of the history is so interesting. You write that during the Cold War, Republicans saw birth control and family planning as a way to strengthen capitalism around the world. What do they see as the connection between family planning and strengthening capitalism?
Basically, at the time, overpopulation was an issue of public concern almost analogous to the way that global warming is now. It was something that all educated people, you know, had heard about, talked about. It was something that people believed was going to create apocalyptic devastation in the very near future. And a lot of Republicans, or just kind of Cold War national security types, thought that overpopulation was going to cause so much misery in the developing world that it was going to lead a lot of these countries to communist revolution.
So you say a lot of the global family planning infrastructure was actually created by Republicans during the Cold War. Give us some examples of that family planning infrastructure created by Republicans.
Well, an obvious example would be George H.W. Bush, who was absolutely obsessed with this issue, who saw family planning as crucial to the future of world prosperity, American prosperity. He presided over international family planning conferences where he tried to convince other nations to adopt population control measures. You know, he was so concerned about this issue that people used to call him Rubbers. You also had Dwight Eisenhower, who not only, you know, wrote about this issue, but was actually at one point a co-chairman of Planned Parenthood. And even during the Nixon administration was seen in many ways as a golden age of family planning. And it was during the Nixon administration that Americans first pushed for the creation of the United Nations Population Fund, which today is really enemy number one for many on the right.
What does it do? What does it fund?
Well, initially, it just funded population control, and it did, you know, population control research and funded contraception and sterilization and that sort of thing. Things have changed a lot since then, and now it's much more involved in a kind of global program of women's empowerment. So it fights for women's education, against fistula, against female genital mutilation, or what some people call female circumcision. It's involved in this much broader kind of program of women's health and rights. But it was really founded as an agency of population control.
So during the Cold War, when American political leaders saw family planning as a weapon against communism, what was happening in the communist countries with birth control? What were their birth control and abortion policies like?
Well, this is something that's so interesting because obviously China today is the kind of apotheosis of coercion with the one-child policy, and they're absolutely obsessed with getting their birth rate down. But at this time, their policy was just as the kind of Republican policy was the mirror image of what it is today. So was the Chinese policy. They believed that more people equaled more power and that these efforts by the developed world to reduce human numbers was just an attempt to weaken them and, you know, was just a kind of another front for imperialism.
Okay, so you're painting this picture where, you know, it's Republicans who are really pushing for family planning because they see it as a weapon in the Cold War. Is there a line where that changes, where positions change and suddenly the Republican Party moves more against family planning or, you know, at least against birth control and on the far end of the right, maybe against contraception too?
Yeah, I think that that kind of culminates with the rise of the religious right and the kind of rise of Nixonian, you know, silent majority politics, the rise of kind of cultural populism. I mean, and it wasn't just Republicans. It was this kind who was initially pushing for family planning. It was this kind of Cold War consensus that this was a huge issue that the United States had to tackle. So, you know, it was Harry Truman and Eisenhower who were co-chairmen of Planned Parenthood. What happened, I think, was that birth control and abortion became associated in the American mind with the counterculture. You saw the rise of the religious right in the 1970s. You saw this kind of attempt by Nixon that's been followed by all later Republicans to capture working class Catholics. And so it became just another issue in the culture war.
You write that in the 70s, a group of feminist-minded women who came up through the ranks of the population control movement decided to take it over from within. And their goal was that women's rights and women's health had to be ends in themselves, that population control wasn't the only goal. It was about women's rights mm-hmm. and women's health. So how did that change the movement?
Well, population control was often kind of quite callous about the way women made decisions, about the kind of lives that they wanted to live, about why they had so many children. You know, it tended to think of them in these very coldly impersonal technocratic terms. And then it was the women who came up through the movement who said, the kind of things you're talking about have no relation to what we see of women's lives, and that you can't just, you know, kind of open sterilization camps or, you know, try to bribe people into getting an IUD inserted. You know, there are reasons that women have so many children, and you need to kind of look at the entire spectrum of their lives. You know, so as I think, you know, many of us know now, one of the best ways both to bring down family size and to increase the number of children who survive and increase child health is to educate women. You know, when you educate women when they work, when they have more power about the kind of decisions that they make within their own households, you have a kind of much more holistic improvement in children's health that translates to lower population sizes.
How successful were the feminists within the population control movement in defining the issue as about women's rights?
Well, by 1994, when there was this huge conference in Cairo, you basically had kind of the feminists succeed in writing the platform. So no longer was the language about population control. It was about reproductive rights, reproductive health. That's the paradigm now, and that's what shifted. And it can sound like just kind of so much verbiage, or it can sound as if there's, you know, this is just a kind of new gloss put on a kind of old Malthusian program. But it really has changed the way that these things operate on the ground. And slowly, it's also changed international law so that we now have reproductive rights basically recognized in international law, which is quite a new thing and I think hasn't gotten the kind of attention that it deserves.
You know, a point that you've made is that the passage of Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion in the United States, turned reproductive issues into larger issues about women's rights, women's reproductive rights. It wasn't just about family planning. And if you can, you just describe a little bit how you think that resonated around the world?
Sure. Well, it's not even that it was just Roe versus Wade that transformed the issue in that way. It was that Roe versus Wade, first of all, you know, transformed the issue to one about local sovereignty versus, you know, the kind of abstract and tyrannical power of the federal courts. And at the same time, it happened as the feminist movement was itself kind of gaining steam. And so groups that had really not been that concerned about abortion in the past, you know, most evangelical groups had not gotten unduly worked up about abortion. You know, they generally saw that as a Catholic issue, and they saw the Catholics as their theological enemies. But because they emerged in response to, you know, the social chaos of the 60s and 70s, as abortion became kind of synonymous with the feminist movement, with the breakdown of the family, they reacted. And so abortion has become the kind of symbol of everything that they feel has gone wrong in American society since the 1950s. And one of the things I think is fascinating is that it's only usually when abortion is understood in these terms that it becomes really contentious. India legalized abortion at around the same time that the United States did, and it's never been an issue in that country. There's no anti-abortion movement save for a few kind of Catholic groups. And part of the reason for that is that it was always done under the kind of rubric of population control. It had nothing to do with changes in gender roles, and thus it didn't really seem to threaten people. Japan is similar. I mean, Japan legalized abortion far before we did. It was actually, I think, the first country to do so. But again, when it was just presented in terms of population control, it didn't seem to upset people that much. It's the change in gender roles and the change in gender dynamics that is this kind of symbol of the end of one order and the kind of onrushing of the modern world that always, in different ways in different countries, but over and over again, creates these big upheavals.
You write that although a lot of religious conservatives weren't really fans of the UN or of, you know, global political groups, they learned from the success of the international women's movement when it came to reproductive issues and in many ways started to imitate the women's movement. Give me some examples of what you mean.
Well, basically, a lot of the stuff that the United Nations does is kind of opaque, especially to Americans. It's hard to see how some of the decisions and statements that come out of these big conferences actually affect people's lives. But abroad, they really, really do. And so as kind of some of these conservative groups became more and more aware of that, they got consultative status within the UN, which gives them the ability to attend all these meetings as NGOs and to put on their own meetings, you know, to put on their own kind of sessions during some of these global conferences. They also just started organizing to stack the delegations so that, you know, you have these delegations, they negotiate all of these seemingly obscure decisions, but again, that have quite a lot of impact. So they would start kind of lobbying to get their people on the delegation so that, you know, instead of, say, having a professor of public health from Columbia University, you started to have, you know, a kind of famous televangelist or somebody from the Family Research Council or something stacking a lot of these delegations. And then they also started networking. There's now something called the World Congress of Families, which brings together religious fundamentalists and religious conservatives from all around the world, you know, in which they put aside their theological disputes and they meet every 2 years and they try to form common cause against what they see as the real enemy, which is, you know, feminists and secularists and liberals.
Now, you say that the U.S. found support for its anti-abortion policies in some of the more repressive quarters of the Middle East and North Africa. And as an example, you give a UN family planning conference in 2002 where American delegates joined hands with delegates from Iran and Sudan. Can you talk about that alliance at this conference?
Well, this is you know, this kind of amazing irony because, right, this is after September 11th. This is at a time when the United States is ostensibly at war with this axis of evil. And yet there's always been people on the Christian right, although obviously hostile to Islam on a theological level, who recognize that their kind of real allies when it comes to social policy are Iran and Sudan and Saudi Arabia. And that would almost sound like a slander if it was just me saying it. But, you know, in this book, you'll see it's often them saying it. And so they realized that if you're going to have a bloc at the United Nations that's going to fight improvements in the spread of reproductive rights, if you're going to fight, you know, any attempts to expand women's rights in international law, you're going to need to form a bloc to stand against the many countries that are seeking to expand women's rights at the global level. So the natural allies of, you know, you have on the one hand, you have France and Britain, Canada, all these Japan, you know, are kind of countries who should be our natural allies. But under Republican leadership, you consistently saw the United States willing to put aside all of its, you know, it's interesting. The United States was refusing to talk to Iran about so many things, but they were willing to talk to them and to cooperate with them when it came to this, which in a way also shows what a serious threat they see women's rights and reproductive rights to be.
For your book, you not only research the shifting American position on family planning. You also traveled to Africa. You traveled to Latin American countries. Now, you say in Africa, there are countries in East Africa where botched abortions are responsible for a third of maternal deaths. Give us just a sense, just looking at this very big continent, how reproductive issues affect larger health issues for women.
Well, it's so profound, and I think I had read about some of these numbers, but they don't become real to you until you visit some of these hospitals. You know, I've been in hospitals in Ethiopia and in Nairobi and Kenya where doctors who work in gynecological wards will tell you that that is what they do all day. They clean up botched abortions all day long. In the vast majority of sub-Saharan African countries, these laws banning abortion are basically left over from colonial constitutions. So the countries that gave them these laws, you know, England and France, have long since left them behind, but they've remained in place in almost all of Africa. And I think, you know, we all know that maternal mortality in Africa is a global scandal. One in every 26 women is going to die in childbirth in Africa. And in some countries, it's one in six women is going to die in childbirth. And so you can't solve maternal mortality by legalizing abortion and providing safe abortion. But you also can't cut maternal mortality without doing that. If you have, you know, unsafe abortion responsible for a third of maternal deaths, it's one of the easiest ways that you can start to bring down some of these, you know, scandalously high numbers. And the other piece of this, of course, is just the kind of shockingly inadequate provision of contraception, right? High abortion rates mean that there's a really big failure of contraception. And it's interesting that in these countries where abortion is illegal, abortion rates are shockingly high. They're higher than they are in the United States. And so these laws are not, you know, protecting life as abortion opponents would have it. They are simply kind of driving women to these kind of brutal and desperate measures to, and, you know, women know in general when they can support a pregnancy and when they can't. And it takes a lot to get a woman to have a child when she doesn't want to or is not ready to.
One of the places you went to for your research was Uganda, where a domestic reform bill had failed. What were the provisions of this failed bill?
You know, often when you get to some of these countries, it's kind of shocking how much we take for granted here in terms of rights that are still completely out of reach for people, for women in other countries. And so this particular reform bill, it had a number of provisions, but the one that proved the most contentious was the one that would have banned spousal rape. Men were outraged at the notion that they could be charged for raping their wives. You actually had legislators arguing that the real violence lay in women who refused to have sex with their husbands. And so, you know, in a country where AIDS is a enormous problem, where marriage is a primary risk factor, and where women have no ability in many cases to, you know, ask, much less force their husbands to use condoms, even what seems to us like a relatively obvious reform had people marching in the streets in kind of mocking opposition.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Michelle Goldberg, author of the new book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. It's about how reproductive rights have become the focal point of the global culture wars. Goldberg's previous book was about the rise of Christian nationalism in the U.S. She's a former senior writer for Salon.com and is now a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Your book opens with the story of a woman who became the Minister of Health in Ghana. Mm-hmm. And it's the story of how she switched from being anti-abortion to pro-choice. Would you just tell us a capsule version of her story?
Sure. Well, she was the stepdaughter of an Anglican minister, had very conservative views, kind of the typical views of her class, you know, a kind of upper middle class educated woman living in Ghana. And she told me about when she was in training, when she was a resident, women who had come into the hospital with botched abortions were put in something called the Chouinard Ward. And they were essentially kind of left on the floor until everyone else in the hospital had been taken care of. When everyone else in the hospital had been taken care of, they would be kind of marched across the courtyard to have their evacuations done without people really cleaning the operating rooms. I mean, they were just, you know, as she told me, they treated them like the scum of this earth. And what changed her mind was when a family that she was treating, and she had become very close to them, when their daughter, who she, you know, really loved, came to her and asked her for something to bring on a late period. This was a 14-year-old girl who didn't really understand what was happening to her. And she sent her away angrily and told her to send her mother. And then a few days
later,
because
she opposed abortion at that point.
She opposed abortion and was kind of horrified that this girl would even ask for something like that. So she sent her away. And then a few days later, she heard noise. Well, she heard some drumming and heard noises while she was in her office. And a nurse told her that it was the funeral procession for this young girl, Amina, who it turned out that the older man who had gotten her pregnant had, after this doctor refused her, the older man had taken her to some kind of traditional quack. He had tried to do an abortion. It had killed her. And this doctor described that to me as her kind of road to Damascus. She was really devastated by that and has since become kind of one of the most important advocates for reproductive rights in all of Africa.
What's her name?
Her name is Dr. Eunice Brookman Amisa.
The people who got into positions of influence internationally during the George W. Bush administration, and I'm referring here to positions pertaining to birth control and abortion. What happens now during the Obama administration? Do new appointees replace them?
Yeah, the vast majority of those people were appointees who will now be replaced. I mean, you know, one really good example is Mark Dybul, who was the head of the president's global AIDS program, which is called PEPFAR. And Mark Dybul was not in many cases, you know, he didn't come from a conservative background, but he proved very willing to kind of hew to the conservative line, since that was the way to get evangelicals invested into global AIDS programs. You know, so he was, you know, would often side with them against contraception and against various kind of women's reproductive health issues. You know, one of the first things that happened when Hillary Clinton became the Secretary of State. Hillary Clinton is someone who has a long history with the international women's movement, who's been very strong on these issues. And no sooner had she been appointed, or no sooner had she no sooner had she taken office than he was told kind of unceremoniously to leave by the end of the day.
So you think that will be happening with other people too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that especially because so many of the people who make important decisions in this area are in the State Department, the fact that there is someone in the State Department who has made global women's rights a priority, it just has a kind of incalculable impact.
Michelle Goldberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Michelle Goldberg is the author of the new book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. We're going to listen back to an interview with Jack Wrangler, who was a gay porn icon in the 70s and early 80s. He died last week of emphysema at the age of 62. Jack Stillman took the stage name Jack Wrangler when he started stripping in a show in L.A. With the name Wrangler, he helped bring the macho gay image to pop culture. When clothed, his trademark was tight-fitting jeans and a flannel shirt, unbuttoned to reveal his muscular physique. In the late 70s, he met the famous singer Margaret Whiting, who was over 20 years older than him. They became close companions, and in 1994 became husband and wife. Whiting is the daughter of the songwriter Richard Whiting, and Johnny Mercer was like an uncle to her. Jack Wrangler produced a couple of Mercer tribute shows that she starred in. When I spoke with Jack Wrangler in 1985, we had an adult conversation about adult films, a conversation that may not be appropriate for young children. I asked him first about how he developed his stripping routine.
I always figured that men should really strip differently than women. You know, women are always the tease thing and the little off-the-shoulder stuff and everything. I never really thought of a man doing it that way. I always thought of them as more rugged, and if it rip it off or get up. But so I walked on stage the first time, and they'd had all these little dancers on, which I don't knock. I can't do it. But I just walked on stage and smoked a cigarette. And people thought that was fascinating. I stood there and did that whole macho thing where you put it between the thumb and the forefingers, right, and you squint. And didn't. And I have a sort of a Scotch voice anyway. That I didn't have to invent. I think it seems to get lower every year. You're saying I live with Margaret Whiting. Her voice is as low as mine in the mornings. We sound exactly alike. But so I had that voice, and so I started using that on stage along with the cigarette because I figured I couldn't just stand there and smoke forever. And I started talking about how I got off on being outdoors and that the ruggedness of the sun and the rocks and the trees. She's getting hysterical while I'm doing this. And as I was saying that, it would get hot. And so, of course, the shirt would come off. And it was all that kind of thing, but it was all... And they would play this very kind of romantic music behind me. I'm so glad you weren't there, because you would have started to laugh, then I would have started to laugh, and the whole thing would have been over. I would have never had this wonderful career.
Did you enjoy it? Was it fun?
No, I was scared to death. I didn't enjoy it at all. I thought, what have I gotten myself into? And I also thought, and my parents had told me, that I had closed a lot of doors, you know, and that I was not going to exactly run back out and get into a soap. But remember, one hadn't been offered to me either. I always make the joke about that I was not offered the Brady Bunch, and so I ended up doing this. But it is true that I wasn't going to wait around for somebody to make me a personality. I wanted it then. And at that time, the X-rated film industry was coming into its own. That was new, too. I seem to have carved a lot of new industries.
What year are we talking about?
It's not so long ago. It was about 10 years ago, about 1973, 74. 74, I guess. We really didn't have that. Pornography was just starting to be a big American thing. It had been a European import for all those years. And I remember that, boy, we got so excited when we saw those magazines with the girls playing volleyball. You know, that was the first stuff that came out that was considered X-rated. And then we got real sophisticated fast. But I remember when I did it, it was a very strange law. You were allowed to make the films, and I think you were allowed to own the films, but you weren't allowed to sell the films or distribute the films or something like that. It was a postal law more than anything else. And so when I did my first film, it was done as a mail order loop. It was a thing of me alone, and it was a short thing that was on 8mm film. And remember those days? And then everybody would put those on the projectors and they'd go rattling off on the floor and you'd be chasing around hundreds of yards of film. Well, I did one of those and I was alone on a ranch sitting on a fence.
When you started stripping, were you already out? Were you already officially gay?
What is officially gay?
I mean, had you decided for certain that at least for them, that you were gay?
That I was attracted to guys?
That, yeah.
Well, I was fooling around, I remember. I really wasn't doing that much of anything at that time. I didn't think that highly of myself physically. And I was more concerned in creating an image than living a lifestyle sexually one way or another at that time. I was getting close to being almost asexual, I think. I'd had a couple of crummy relationships and some very nice ones, I guess, with people. It was more like with me, it was more like the guys at summer camp or going off on a fraternity binge or something. I thought if you were gay that you had to be doing all kinds of things that I didn't even know about until I had to do them in a film.
How did you develop your persona after that strip act, which you had described? How did you go on to develop the persona that you would have in subsequent movies and stage performances?
Well, part of it had to do with a manager that worked with me at that time named Bob Meyer. And he helped package this whole persona of Jack Wrangler. And I guess I don't know where the flannel shirt thing came in. But once it did, I guess I did a couple of photo essays and stuff with the flannel shirt. And people, I got a good response from it, so I kept doing it. I remember that Bob then would push all these things down everybody's throat. I mean, you couldn't open a magazine without me advertising or endorsing something. I endorsed insurance companies. I endorsed – remember they had me all tied up in conduits and saying something about don't get all tied up, Jack Wrangler. It was always Jack Wrangler says, so that to keep the name and the face. There's a Jack Wrangler bathing suit that our men – put out. We had a thing called Intermountain Logging Company that was Levi's and flannel shirts. That's all they sold, and belt buckles, I think. And all to keep this really not Western image as much as highly almost caricature of masculinity, which is very true in the gay X-rated films. It's much more stereotyped than in the straight X-rated films. You have your construction worker, and you have your outdoorsman, and you have the lineman. A telephone lineman is big. I did a window washer once where they suspended me 17 stories over the Ansonia Hotel with a strange squeegee. and I did... I've played cops, I've played wardens, I've played, you know, all those very rough and tumble kind of characters that have never seen a bed before in their lives.
Somebody once said that we fall in love with people who we want to become ourselves, but we're incapable of becoming.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you kind of created a persona for yourself
who
wasn't
sure.
like you at all?
It was a Walter Mitty dream. It wasn't anything like me. And that's exactly the guy I'd always wanted to be. You know, some lumberjack kind of type. I'd always wanted to be like that. And I felt because of my upbringing and having an upbringing with governesses and all that stuff, boy, it really makes you feel emasculated. I even had to hold my napkin a certain way and dab my mouth. I mean, we were taught all about, I was a highly mannered child. Dressed for dinner and all that kind of thing. And so, of course, what I wanted to be was a rancher. That would be the obvious thing. I wanted to get out of those little short pants and the Lord Fauntleroy outfits and get into some rugged stuff and be a real man. You know? And so that is, a lot of those over-exaggerated characteristics began to mellow after a few years. I think I got bored with them, or I started feeling more self-confident, which I did. I did gain a lot of self-confidence out of doing all this. You know, I was painfully shy before this.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not anymore.
And self-conscious, too.
Oh, very much so. I'm still self-conscious, but I'm not painfully shy anymore.
What would it be like if you met somebody who you were going to have an affair with or something?
Mm-hmm.
And they
happens.
Yeah, well, no, and they expected you to be Jack Wrangler. I mean, who you are, but what I mean is they expected you to have that kind of outdoorsy background instead of being brought
up
in Beverly Hills.
Oh, yeah, to behave that way at home, you know. That happens a lot. If somebody goes home with me and they know of me as Jack Wrangler, then they're going to expect a certain, I imagine, a certain thing. I can't blame that on them. I blame it on me. For creating something that's such an outrageous character to begin with, that the worst thing is that they expect other people to live up to that character, and that's I feel awful when people say I broke up with my lover because he didn't think that I was as masculine as Jack Wrangler. And I said, well, either am I. Who is?
Well, you had said that you had kind of fantasized about a character like that when you were younger, and you kind of became that character. Mm-hmm. But maintain some ironic distance from that character as well. Do you still harbor any romantic fantasies about that kind of really macho, outdoorsy guy, or has all of that been kind of erased in the knowledge that you now have about how that image can be created?
Well, I got a lot of it out of my system by doing it and playing it on the screen. That was a nice release. But I think that still, I'm very attracted to the outdoors and would love to have a Jeep and a big dog and a ranch somewhere, you know, and that I would enjoy. But as long as it was only 45 minutes from Saks. but sure, I still harbor that. And anytime I hear about somebody just went off to become a forest ranger or a fireman or something, I think, oh, they did the right thing. You know, they're going to have a wonderful life.
How did you make the transition, and why did you make the transition from gay X-rated to straight X-rated movies?
Well, for one thing, I figured if you're going to be the top of the X-rated industry, you better not limit yourself to just one small part. I mean, why be a nurse when you can be a doctor? That would sort of apply here. It had always been my plan to be both the top of the gay and the straight X-rated industry, and I wanted to have that simultaneously because, I don't know, and also I wanted to be continuing as a legit director and writer as well because I wanted to prove only in America, Horatio Alger, right, that could one do all of that and be a wonderful guide for children everywhere. You too could do this. But it was really kind of the plan. We were going to become the top of the gay first because in the straight films at that time, you couldn't get your name over the title if you were a guy. Only the girls got them over the title. That changed when I went into the straight films. My first one, I was over the title because I had been a name in the gay thing, and they thought that they might get a lot of those people to go over and see the straight films. So they did it as a merchandising gimmick. And so it made sense for me to do first the gay and then go into the straight. But the first straight film I did was a thing called Two China Sisters. And it was about two, believe it or not, China sisters who were really not China. One was from Santa Barbara, I think, and one was from Sherman Oaks or something with a lot of makeup. And the two girls that decided to take this gay boy and make him straight, which they do by the end of the reel. And that was it.
That was your initiation into heterosexuality, wasn't it?
It was, as well. It was a big red letter day. I felt like I'd been bar mitzvahed.
It must have been very weird to have your first heterosexual encounter in front of cameras.
Yeah.
And crew.
Yeah. Most of it was funny because they were really cheering me on, you know. This is really like, boy, the kid's really coming into his own today. My son, you are a man. And all these people the crew's always standing out the set with bagels and things, you know. They're always eating, those people. And standing there with their bagels and saying, yay, Jack, go to it.
What's the lifespan of the working lifespan of someone in pornography? Do you reach a certain age where people don't want to see you naked anymore because, as far as they're concerned, you're too old?
I don't know whether it's a numbers thing as much as it is whether somebody starts to fall apart.
Well, this is something you worry about. I know, like athletes when they start
every breathing
in pro
moment
ball,
of my
know?
Life. Uh-huh. But I would worry about it anyway. I worry about it in my personal life too. If I don't get to I feel this last 3 weeks I've been working on a project and haven't been able to go to the gym and I've been traveling a lot and I feel awful, ugly, terrible, unwanted, unclean. I feel because I haven't been pumping up and getting everything exactly where it's supposed to be. Oh, yeah, I'm terrible about all that stuff. It's become a phobia. Isn't that a damn shame? Christopher Reeves once said that he thought it was so stupid that people went to gyms and so he said he only did it for Superman. And when he doesn't have to do that role, he could care less about going through all the routine. And it is kind of dumb because you go to this gym and pump up these muscles and they just go right back down again. I mean, they don't stay there or anything. So your whole life is spent locked in a gym. I think that we're much too overly concerned with it now. Wasn't it great in the old days when not just anybody worked out? I thought that was terrific. It's like when not just anybody flew, you know, and stuff. Now everybody goes to a gym. Everybody looks great. And it's no big deal anymore.
But as you get older, do you ever feel like we're really, like, too obsessed with youth and with
good looks
and all that?
Oh, we certainly are. And every year I say that even with a stronger voice, that we're much too obsessed with youth. I think we should become obsessed with middle age.
Thanks a lot for talking.
Thank you, Terry.
Really,
I had a wonderful time.
Jack Wrangler recorded in 1985. He died of emphysema last week at the age of 62. After his gay porn career, he went on to produce theater and cabaret, including music revues starring Margaret Whiting, who became his wife in 1994. We're remembering Jack Wrangler, who died last week at the age of 62. People who didn't know Jack Wrangler and Margaret Whiting were mystified by their relationship. A former gay film icon married to a famous singer more than 20 years older than him. But they were together for decades, although they didn't marry until 1994. Margaret Whiting is the daughter of songwriter Richard Whiting. Johnny Mercer was like an uncle to her. Jack Wrangler produced a couple of Johnny Mercer tribute shows Margaret Whiting starred in. In 1988, she told me how she met Wrangler back in 1976.
There's a wonderful place in New York where everybody would go in show business and everybody else, called Backstage. And there was a piano player there, and we would be introduced by the owner, Ted Hook. And he had introduced this charming gentleman that I was looking at across a table. But I thought I knew him. And they'd said his name was Jack Wrangler, and he was doing such and such a picture. I wasn't paying much attention. Then they introduced me, and I got up and took a bow, and then Jack came over to the table. He said, I've loved your singing, and I'm an admirer, and I think you're terrific. I knew him. Now, I had met him as Jack Stillman, who was a director in Chicago and doing all the top shows there. But he had gone to a gym, and his body had changed, and he's changed his hairstyle. So I said, I didn't recognize him. I said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm doing my act. So I said, good, I'd love to see it. He said, well, you can come next Wednesday night. I'll have my stage manager leave tickets. So that was that, and he left. And Ted Hook came over to me and said, you said you were going to see his act? I said, yes. He said, do you know what he does? I said, no. He said, well, he makes porn pictures. I said, you're kidding. He's so charming. He says, he is charming. I said, Ted, I don't understand. A week ago, he introduced me to Jamie Gillis, who was going with a gal that's a wonderful food critic, and he's in porn pictures. I said, a few weeks before, you introduced me to Harry Reams. What is this? He said, well, they're all great guys, and they all come to the restaurant. So anyway, it was too late. I thought about it. And so a girlfriend of mine and Ted Hook and somebody else went with me. We went to the theater. Jack couldn't have been nicer. He was very charming. He got up. He talked about how he got into porn pictures and some of the funny things that had happened. And he introduced me. And I got up and took a bow. And then he came to out front and said, I'd love to see you again. So we made a date for brunch. And we sat at my house for a while and went downstairs to brunch. And I found out that he had the same kind of background I did. He came from Beverly Hills. He had been a kid star. He'd won an Emmy for Faith of Our Children. And he'd been directing. And then suddenly, I don't know, he wanted to get out of that. He wanted to go back to Hollywood and act, and he couldn't get a job. He tried. So he got a job in a play. And I guess he took his shirt off, and then he took his pants off. He wasn't nude, but somebody came to him and said, oh, we want to do another play. And some film man saw him and said, would you do this part in this picture? And that's how he got into it.
He made his reputation in gay porn films.
First, and then he went into heterosexual films.
It must have been seemed a potentially very treacherous kind of relationship
yes.
to get involved in.
Yes, and I had no intention of getting involved. But we had the same kind of background. We went to the same schools years apart, went to the same dancing schools. And then you've met Jack, and you know the kind of person he is. He's a very fine person. And I realized that he'd gotten into this somehow, and he didn't know how to get out. But then I talked to Jack, and I said, look, you're a very fine director, and you're a good actor. You should come to New York, where they're far more forgiving and understanding. And he realizes that there was no future in it, but he was stuck in it in a while. There was nothing else he could do.
There's a 20-year age gap between you. You're 20 years older than he is. And I wonder if being in a relationship like that has made you feel older or younger.
It's made me feel just as I always feel. Age has never meant an important thing to me. And Jack and I have a terrific time. We work together. He'll do my act. He'll direct my act or find me material. I help him with what he's doing. I listen to every scene that he writes. I helped him with his book. I mean, I read every chapter and made suggestions. And we're very helpful to each other and as people. We find there's a need for each other. And we've never even worried about the age.
Margaret Whiting recorded in 1988. Jack Wrangler died last week. We'll close with Whiting singing a song with music by her father, Richard Whiting, and lyrics by her mentor, Johnny Mercer. I'm Terry Gross.
You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous, that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they're just not swell enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very.